coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware State University's acquisition of Wesley College will also have an impact on DSU's charter school as the early college school gets the green light to expand.
They're confident that adding the middle school will result in improved performance levels because they will be giving students two more years to work and learn in a rigorous and challenging academic environment.
Contributor Larry Nangest explains the expansion plans on tap for DSU's early college school. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also have our latest arts playlist, which puts a spotlight on the latest offering from a Millsboro-based author. And we learn more about the current state of TV news in the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware State University is in the final stages of completing its acquisition of Wesley College. The move means major changes for students and staff at both institutions, but another school is also affected in a significant way. DSU's Early College High School is also about to see big changes connected to the deal. Contributor Larry Nangest explains what's happening at the DSU-run charter school in his latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me earlier this week to discuss it. So let's start with a brief history of DSU's early college high school. When did it start, and what's the mission of this charter school been so far?
Well, Early College High School opened on Delaware State University's Dover campus in the fall of 2014 and graduated its first senior class in 2018. Its mission is to serve students from demographics that are not typically college-bound. We're talking about low-income youth, first-generation college families, English language learners, and students of color. Now, as a charter school, Early College High School does have to accept whoever applies up to its authorized enrollment limits. But a majority of the school students do fit within these categories that I just mentioned. The school's major attraction is its affiliation with Delaware State. It's a partnership that enables students to take a year's worth of college classes and sometimes significantly more while they're still in high school.
So how will its operations change with the charter school modifications approved by the State Board of Education last week for early college?
In terms of enrollment, the big change is that it will be adding a middle school for the 2022-2023 school year. That means 150 more students, 75 in the 7th grade and 75 in the 8th grade. And then that will fill out to 100 students in each of those grades in the future years. And that would pretty much match the size of each class in the high school, which the total enrollment is just over 400 right now. Now, as the school grows, interestingly enough, its name will shrink. Rather than being the Early College High School at Delaware State University, the name will become simply Early College at Delaware State University.
So how does the school see the middle school curriculum fitting in with its mission of prepping students for college? Middle schoolers aren't going to be taking some classes alongside college students like the early college high school students do, right?
The idea here is to give students from underrepresented college demographics even more of a head start in preparing for college. Start talking about college sooner. Build good study habits sooner. Take some high school classes while in eighth grade so there's even more room to take college classes while you're in high school. And no, the middle school students won't start taking college classes that early. Even the current early college students don't start taking college-level classes alongside the regular Delaware State students until their second year of high school.
So is there any model or precedent for this kind of setup that the school leaders look at as they move toward this expansion? Is there something that they kind of use as a kind of precedent for building what they're building?
Well, this early college model is not unique to Delaware State. In fact, Delaware State officials visited comparable programs across the country before they opened the school 7 years ago. Dr. Evelyn Edney, who is the current principal, visited other early college programs before she came on board in 2015. So she'd get a better handle of what they were like because she had come from traditional high schools prior to this in her career. One of the schools that she visited did have a middle school as well as part of its program, and that's where she got the idea for Delaware State. Now, as for this related idea, many of the career pathways programs that have become increasingly popular in Delaware's public schools start guiding students on routes to specific careers when they are in seventh grade. So this idea of a path from middle school through high school into college and into a career is something that's people in Delaware should be familiar with. Also, Tony Allen, who is Delaware State president, university president, mentioned the long-running FAME program as an example. Now, FAME, which stands for Forum to Advance Minorities in Engineering, is a program that was started way back in 1976 by the DuPont Company, and it still operates, and it provides ongoing mentoring for minority middle school and high school students who are interested in science and technology careers. So again, another example of this six-year program running from the middle school years through the end of high school. So plenty of history here that points to the value of putting seventh graders on the fast track to higher education.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the school's planned use of Wesley College as part of this expansion and what advantages that would provide compared to the school's current setup? It feels like it's going to use a sizable amount of Wesley's facilities once that transaction for DSU to acquire Wesley is complete this summer.
Well, yes, I would say a sizable amount, but we're not quite sure yet. As part of the charter modification approved by the State Board of Education, the early college program will move to the Wesley College campus in downtown Dover as of July 1st of 2022. As most people probably know, Delaware State is in the process of acquiring Wesley, and that deal is scheduled to close in 2 months. And I guess one thing that Wesley and Delaware State have already announced is that Delaware State's School of Health and Behavioral Sciences is going to be combined with Wesley's programs in that area, and that is going to remain on the Wesley campus. Anyhow, currently the early college program does run in two locations. The ninth graders participate in what is called a freshman academy, and that is housed in the old Dover Sheridan Hotel on Route 13. And grades 10 through 12 attend their high school classes in Grossley Hall on the DSU main campus, and then take their regular college classes with DSU students in other buildings on the campus. Now, with the change, the classes for the entire new middle school and for the high school portion of the early college program will be conducted on the Wesley campus. Early college students then will take shuttle buses to the main Delaware State campus for their college-level classes. Now, as I said, no decisions have been made as to which buildings on the Wesley campus the early college program will use, but early college says it will need 20 classrooms, plus a couple of science labs, some music rooms, a cafeteria, an auditorium, and a gym. And they tell me that they also expect to make good use of the athletic facilities at Wesley, including the track, the football and baseball fields, and the gym.
As the school gets ready to grow, do we have a sense of who the school is currently serving, who it hopes to serve, and is there, for lack of a better phrase, a typical early college school student?
Well, I'll try to give you that. As I mentioned earlier, that target demographic is essentially about half of the students at the school. They qualify for free or reduced price lunches. About 10% have special education needs. On the academic side, again, there's no admissions test here, so the school takes whoever it applies up to the limits that are set out in its charter. And that means it serves a fairly broad spectrum, from students who have struggled in the lower grades to those who might be described as academic superstars. But most of them really fall in that broad middle. You know, they're average students who want to go to college. Now, geographically, and this is really interesting, a little bit more than half of the students live in this Capital and Caesar Rodney School District, which you might expect because those are the districts that are closest to the campus in Dover. But the other half come from all over the state. Some come from as far north as Wilmington, and others come from as far south as Georgetown and Laurel. So there's a pretty diverse population here on the campus among the early college students.
Very interesting. Early college is on the DSU campus, as you've mentioned. Its students take college classes there. How strong is the connection between the school and DSU? Is it ostensibly serving as a pipeline to DSU for many of these students?
Well, I think, yeah, pipeline is the perfect description, and that's the word that President Tony Allen mentioned to me when we talked earlier this week. You know, when the university established the school, one of its goals was to create a feeder system, and that is what's happened. More than half of early college's graduates have enrolled at Delaware State, and the connection these students have developed with the university, both in terms of familiarity with the campus and having accumulated up to 2 years' worth of college credits before they get to the college itself, means they're more likely to complete their bachelor's degrees at the school.
And do we know anything about the early college school's track record so far? You mentioned earlier its first class graduate in 2018. Not a huge sample size, but do we have a sense of where these students have gone on to school, the ones who haven't gone to DSU, and if they've had a leg up when they've gotten there?
Again, more than half of the graduates have enrolled at Delaware State University. Many others have chosen to enroll at other historically black colleges and universities across the nation. And because the credits that are earned through the early college program are transferable, those who choose to attend different schools can enroll there at those other schools with advanced standing. What's really fascinating and a very positive sign here is that two of the school's valedictorians, the top graduates in the classes of 2018 and 2020, have enrolled at Stanford University in California. And Stanford, as you know, is one of the most selective colleges in the country.
And finally, what expectations do DSU and early college school officials have for this expanded schools? What are they hoping they'll see as this expansion comes to fruition?
Well, you know, student performance as measured by scores on the preliminary SAT and SAT exams, you know, the college boards, have shown steady improvement grade by grade for the classes over the past 3 years. Graduation rates at the school meet or exceed the averages for Delaware public schools as a whole. More than 90% of the students have had no more than one referral per year to the school office for discipline issues. So, you know, these are all fine, positive numbers. With the addition of the middle school, both the university and early college officials are expecting more of the same. They're confident that adding the middle school will result in improved performance levels because they will be giving students two more years to work and learn in a rigorous and challenging academic environment.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. His piece on the expansion of DSU's early college school is available at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in a moment with Arts Playlist, where we hear about the latest offering from a Millsboro-based author. Stay with us. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A new book from a widely published Millsboro author is out. A Place to Hide is the latest from David Sauner. It focuses on a parole jumper named Bill Waite living on the Lower East Side of Manhattan during the 1920s. Sauner says the story is based in part on his own life. Sauner worked all over the country as an iron ore miner, steelworker, and longshoreman for many years. In this week's Arts Playlist, Sauner chats with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about the book and his past.
Hey, you set the scene without giving too much away. Give us some background about A Place to Hide. What's it about?
Well, it's about 1923, and this fella who's on the run from a cruel Montana parole boss, he arrives in New York. He needs a hideout and someone to trust, and he finds both working on the Holland Tunnel as a sandhog laborer with the first Jew he's ever known, Virgil Pushkin Shulman. So it's a story about the Holland Tunnel, the construction of the Holland Tunnel, the Lower East Side in the 1920s, and about cultures meeting up, this fellow who's never known a Jew and finding shelter on the Lower East Side among Jewish people there.
It sounds like a good mystery. I love a good mystery. How did you come up first with the title, and then how did you come up with, you know, an idea for this story?
Well, the idea comes from several different places. One thing is, I was a blue collar worker for most of my working life. I worked in iron ore mines, steel manufacturing facilities, places like that all over the country. So when I thought about the Holland Tunnel, I thought, I wonder what it would have been like to work there. And that was how I came up with that idea. I also had lived briefly on the Lower East Side way back. Tells something about my age when I say how far that I lived in the Lower East Side when it was still a working class community. So I was fascinated by the remnants of Yiddish and Ukrainian cultures that I saw there. So I put it together and I thought, well, what if a fugitive, what better place to hide than the Lower East Side was in the 1920s the most crowded slum in the world. Who could find anybody there? So that's sort of how the title and the outlines of the story came about.
Now, if you've worked all over the country, tell me how you settled here in Delaware.
Well, a lot of us are settling here in Sussex County. It's a booming area right now, but my wife and I were semi-retired. We're still not completely retired. We were living in Maryland, and we thought we had another move left in us, and we like the kind of life that we're able to live here. It is a great area, and there's a tremendous mix of people where we are. A lot of people from all over the world are in Lower Sussex County, drawn here by the chicken processing plants especially, and then a lot of older people like myself who come here with fascinating backgrounds as well.
Now, A Place to Hide, that's your latest book. That is not your first book, correct?
Correct. I wrote four poetry collections. My last poetry collection is The Stillness of Certain Valleys, which is about the title poem is about working in West Virginia and the ghost towns that exist there now. And that's available on Amazon as well, The Stillness of Certain Valleys.
David, what got you interested initially in writing poetry and then books?
Well, I had young people often write poetry, and it's beaten out of us over the years. We have to go to work, and it just disappears from our the goal of writing something on paper that you really take pleasure in. That disappears over the years with the obligations of work. But for me, when I went to work with steel workers and iron ore miners, machinists and bus drivers on many of the jobs I had, their stories really fascinated me. And so that desire to write was really reborn in me because of the stories of the people that I worked with.
That's some hard work right there. I mean, I can just imagine that it would lead to a whole host of stories right there. It's very hard work, yes?
Yes. And I think I was able to write the story of the Sandhog laborers who built the Holland Tunnel because of that background that I had. I know that people who do extremely hard work, backbreaking work, or people who just work in an office or work serving others in customer service, they know what it's like to be looked down on and to work hard for a pittance. And there's a certain liveliness in those people. The support they give to each other, their jokes. So the Sandhog laborers that I try to capture, actually, I read every book I could, but none of them really describe the life of the Sandhogs. And I think that that's something that I really wanted to do. I'm sure they were a very lively bunch, not just a beaten down and downtrodden bunch.
I want to remind everybody, we are talking to David Salner. David is a local author. He lives in Millsboro, about his latest novel about a fugitive in 1920s Lower East Side Manhattan. And it sounds like an interesting read. Because you live in Sussex County, do you think down the road somewhere we'll see a book about Sussex County, Delaware?
Could be. Although, possibly the most interesting book would come out of someone who's traveled here, possibly from Guatemala, working in a chicken processing plant. That might be the most interesting kind of book to come out of Sussex County, and I would not be qualified to write it. But I think A Place to Hide is a... I tried to strike some universal themes that apply to Delaware and everywhere else.
David, what's the takeaway from your book? What do you want readers to take away?
Well, Kelly, I think the takeaway of my book, A Place to Hide, is of the meeting of people from different cultures. I think that the talk about divisiveness and conflict in society, although there is much of that, there's also a lot of coming together and a lot of people helping each other out. The main character in my book is a parole jumper on the run from a frame-up who's never known a Jew. His best friend becomes Virgil, and Virgil is the first, not only the first Jew he's ever known, but he guides him through the Lower East Side. He rescues him. Bill is also rescued by other characters. It's really a story of Bill's good fortune. The way this man who's on the run is rescued, goes through many close scrapes. I hope readers will find a fair amount of suspense in it. And he's rescued by other lowly characters in the world of 1920s.
What a great message, too, the message of coming together in a world that was turned upside down last year by the COVID pandemic. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, yes. I'm glad you say that, and I hope readers will find that. Readers can get the book on Amazon, as well as by me, if from me, an autographed copy. Kelly, if they write to the station, can you put them in touch with me?
I will definitely do that.
Great. And then I can send an autographed copy.
Thanks to Millsboro-based author David Salner and our Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts, and a look at the current state of television news. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you the latest installment of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts. The podcast delves into identifying trustworthy and reliable sources of news and information as part of Delaware Humanities' mission to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. This season, the podcast more closely examines popular sources of news and information, and on this episode, the spotlight falls on TV news. Cable news, CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, and such, has seen growing viewership, though its numbers seem to be plateauing or dropping a bit with the 2020 election in the rearview mirror. Meanwhile, local TV news had been seeing declining viewership until last year when it got a boost during the pandemic. So where does TV news stand right now, and what does the future hold for it? To help us look at those questions and more, the podcast welcomed Amanda Sturgill, Associate Professor of Journalism at Elon University and author of the book Detecting Deception, Fighting Fake News. Here is the A Matter of Facts podcast. Dr. Sturgill, we appreciate you taking some time to join us on the A Matter of Facts podcast. We're glad to have you with us.
I am so glad to be here.
So like news in so many other mediums, TV news is hardly your mom and dad's TV news. The days of the 6 and 11 local news and the dominance of the evening network news appears to be long gone. Writ large, how has TV news adapted to the changing media landscape compared to news in other mediums?
So I guess I would take issue with the idea that TV news is not your mom and dad's. I think they are the ones who are still there in the audience. But you're right that TV news as an industry has had to adapt as their audience has grown grayer and has shrunk in size. We've seen a group of media and adults that have sort of slipped away from regular appointment viewing of TV news into news online and on social media. And so TV news outlets need to actually reach those audiences there.
And just kind of looking at the numbers, studies have shown that local TV news viewership was trending down in recent years until last year when it appears the COVID-19 pandemic brought some people back. Let's dig in a little bit there. Where do things stand with local TV news viewership? And what does that bump last year in viewership during the pandemic say to you about where local TV news is right now?
Of all sorts is cyclical. They tend to increase their viewers, and they also tend to increase their income during years when there's a lot of political news, which there certainly was last year. And I think you can sort of add the pandemic into that. More people were at home, and they had more of a need to sort of surveil their environment. So that probably accounts for some of the bump. One of the things that is interesting is that although the audience for TV news is shrinking, the money has not really been as much of a problem. So the challenges that they face are kind of different ones. You can see that television news is now carrying some of the burden of print news. The financial model shift has been quite devastating to print news. Whole newspapers have folded or let go of many of their staff. And so in that news is sort of the first draft of history, the burden of creating that first draft is falling some on broadcast. That leads to two different types of challenges. The first one is that when you're trying to attract that audience, analysis programs do well. But audiences don't always tell the difference between news and opinion, right? So news is someone telling you the facts so that you can make up your own mind. But analysis could be someone telling you the facts with context to help you understand it, but is shifting more into giving you some facts in order to sort of persuade you to think in a particular way. And that is kind of contrary to the first draft of history notion that television is picking up from other news outlets. I think the other threat that they're facing is that it's really easy now to create content that looks like news. And that is sort of a two-edged sword, where edge one is that more people have access to create and share content. So you can actually get out of major markets and tell more local stories direct to online, and more people can do it because the technology is easier to use. The other side, though, is that it's easy to create disinformation and misinformation that just fools the audience and makes them believe false things.
I'm curious what you think the impact of these kind of changes in this changing landscape is on kind of the actual content itself. I mean, for the longest time, when I was growing up, a lot of when people talked about TV news, they talked about the idea of, when it bleeds, it leads. Is that changed because of the changing landscape, or is there still a heavy element of that as well?
There's still a heavy element of the visual. I would say that the content of the stories themselves has somewhat gotten more sensational. Even the way that you're sort of breaking down the broadcast and putting in the little bits that are, taking you from place to place in the broadcast and previewing the next parts, they're trying to make some changes to the format to keep viewers that go through there. But again, if I'm a teen news outlet, I'm really not just seeing myself as a 6 and a 10 or probably a 6, a 12, a 6 and a 10 or something like that. But I'm seeing myself as a 24-hour news outlet that is producing in multiple media all the time.
Let's move into the national realm, which is clearly a 24/7 operation when you talk about cable TV news and network news. What do we know about how many people are still watching there and who they are demographically?
Yeah, so cable news is doing pretty well. They're also losing some viewers, but not as many as local news percentage-wise. And they, you know, they're still gaining that audience. They still have that kind of appointment-y audience, which is getting pushed in also by other media. So social media promotion as well as talk radio promotion that is pushing people to some cable news.
So I want to just talk a little bit about some of the challenges that TV news faces. You kind of alluded to some of them earlier. But in terms of keeping and building that viewership and making sure in both cases the revenue is what they need it to be, what are some of the maybe specific challenges that they face, and how do those challenges compare to what print media is having to face and having to navigate in this time?
Okay. Advertising is still present for TV news, both at the local level and at the national level. The fact that we tend to not just have election years now, but we tend to have large amounts of political news, that does pull in a certain kind of an audience, and advertisers recognize that audience is there. On the local level, there are some things that people just need to know are there and available in their community to buy. So local car dealers and sometimes grocery stores and, you know, those kinds of things will still have a need to do sort of mass market advertising. They also have the ability to generate revenue through their websites by getting audience to come to the website and possibly come to the website first, and they can sell ads there in a targeted way. Generally speaking, I think broadcast has been a little bit more successful at making money off of advertising, particularly at the local level, and having advertisers sort of come in, having audience come in for those advertisers through the website.
Is there a distinction to be drawn between major market TV news and smaller market TV news, where it feels like maybe there's more pressures on the smaller markets in that revenue, and then conversely, that means probably fewer staff, more one-man bands, and things like that. Is there a strong kind of gulf between those two versions of local TV news?
Yes. Usually, major market TV news may be a little bit closer to kind of network level and have, you know, better access to support with that. Local market TV news usually has to be more sensitive to the individuals who are in the audience for that news, and that can sometimes maybe shift the tone of content a little bit, because these are, you know, people that you're very close to. Your kids go to school with them, and you see them at the grocery store and those kind of things. And so that can sort of change the tenor of the things that you cover depending on what's going on in your community. Financially, in something like a pandemic, a major market is going to have more access to other kinds of businesses, and also because they reach larger numbers of people, more national level advertising dollars can be spent there, whereas the local market's going to struggle a little bit more with that.
I want to talk about another issue that's gotten some attention, and that's the consolidation of ownership of local stations, specifically, for example, Sinclair having hundreds of stations and questions being raised about some of the content that they're mandating air across those stations. Sinclair did have its effort to purchase Tribune-owned stations halted last year, but is there still kind of a bigger picture concern about fewer hands owning the majority of stations, kind of what radio saw happen a lot kind of just before that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And this is true across media. So anytime that you have consolidation, you are reducing the variety of voices and places for people to get information, right? You're reducing the choices that viewers have, and in that viewers do have agency when they have choices, that can help to shift the coverage in directions that are suitable for, you know, maybe that local community. So you can think of it, we talk about like having a free marketplace of ideas, and the size of that market becomes less free if the message is being controlled through consolidation of ownership.
And I guess the other concern there would be kind of a top-down mandate on what's being covered and kind of almost a homogeneous version of news that goes across multiple markets, as opposed to maybe being more focused on what's happening in an individual market.
Yeah, that's right. And that's not unique to television. That's
right.
Something that you're seeing in newspapers as well.
So having talked about that, where does public trust fit into all this? I mean, local news, TV, and otherwise still seems to have, at least when you look at polls and surveys, solid public trust. But in an increasingly polarized environment, especially politically, you know, can that continue? Will that eventually more or less trickle down even into local news, TV, and otherwise?
Local news has the advantage that you can sort of verify with your own eyes if things are true, whereas national news, generally, you're only finding out about that in some kind of mediated way. We know that trust of the media and trust in particular of television news was already eroding, kind of moving into 2016, when I would say there was a fairly major shift in the U.S. information environment. There was a bigger fall in that after 2016, with the idea of fake news as sort of a memeable, hashtagable, easily shared kind of thing to share, and changing away from news that had an inaccuracy in it to news that maybe the newsmaker didn't like, right? So it was basically, it became sort of an easy ad hominem attack for the media. I expect that you would see that locally as well.
Is that a tougher thing for TV news to fight based on, you know, I guess if you look at some other mediums, particularly say like print, I mean, you have the benefit of maybe perhaps being able to dig deeper into stories, particularly when you're talking kind of like the day-to-day news than TV, which does have to operate more in shorter features or sound bites and things like that. Does that hurt the ability to kind of maintain that trust if people don't feel like they're, for lack of better terms, getting the whole story?
For TV viewers only, yes. I think in the case of both print and in broadcast, the trend has been to be using affiliated websites to actually provide links to primary source documents, to provide sort of interpretive things where you take data and maybe do data visualizations and those kind of things. And that can be helpful for some skeptical members of the audience. But you're right that if you're just watching, you know, a 90-second, you know, little clip on a news station, then it's hard to go back and like verify original sources of that information.
So you mentioned the idea of fake news, and we mentioned at the top of your book, Detecting Deception, Fighting Fake News. In that book, you talk about things like distractions and deception, unrelated evidence, issues with numbers. Are there any of these issues that you feel are more prevalent to TV news than other mediums that you were examining in that book?
Yes. So anything in the news environment is a good bit more deconstructive than it used to be. So it used to be that, you know, dead trees would arrive on your doorstep in a package, or you had your 30 minutes that you spent with Dan Rather at night that were all packaged together, and it was easy to see what news was. But people are now getting news in multiple different ways at multiple different times of the day. We have less of what we call appointment viewing for TV news. Even if people are looking at your actual package, they're seeing one piece of a whole broadcast on a website. That makes it harder to understand context. Also, there is a big demand for live video. And so this is live video that sometimes comes from TV news itself. And TV news gets pressured to do that because now anybody can be a live broadcaster with a device in their pocket. And so more things are getting carried live. What we saw is that news outlets got better at fact-checking. So actual, is information correct or is information not correct kind of things. Even sometimes in a live context, you know, they could put something on the bottom that says, you know, this wasn't true. They are not as good at checking these deceptive bits of language where people are trying to basically say something that's not actually untrue, but makes you think the wrong thing. And so an example I could give you from the news that's going on this week is the trial, the Chauvin trial, mm-hmm. over the death of George Floyd. And so you will see people saying things, you know, and sometimes these are getting broadcast live as people are giving their opinions or being, you know, asked about stuff saying, well, George Floyd maybe passed a counterfeit bill. I don't think this is a settled matter of fact, and he was not on trial and convicted for anything, but that is something people will accuse him of. That is a logic error, right? Because you're basically attacking someone's character and then sort of implying that anything else that happened is a result of that. And people, it just kind of goes by and people can't think quickly enough to think, well, that doesn't make sense or that's completely irrelevant to what we're talking about right now.
So with the mind, are there ways people can be better consumers of TV news or any news for that matter I know I saw in one place you had suggested perhaps there is, and this is what you were kind of alluding to just a moment ago, to go beyond fact-checking and do sense-checking. Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by sense-checking?
Yeah. So I suggest thinking about sort of a three-part test when you see bits of information. So who is the information being shared by? Why would that person be sharing that information? And then is the information actually coming with any evidence? And if you think about those things as new pieces of information come in, that can help you sometimes to identify disinformation or when it's being spread as misinformation. I also think it's helpful to look for information from a variety of different sources. People will tend to have one or two things that they like and follow all the time, or they will get information from anywhere and not think about where it comes from. And I don't think either of those are very robust strategies. And it's better to have, you know, a variety of sources from different points of view that you look at regularly to try to understand things in their context.
Is that particularly true at the national cable news level? I mean, we hear a lot of people talk all the time about people kind of get into their echo chambers, whether it be Fox News or MSNBC or CNN. Is that more of an issue, do you think, there at that national level, that people can kind of get stuck in one particular bubble and not be seeing anything else that might challenge what they're hearing?
I think it is true at the national level. I think it's true with social media that you might choose to follow, whether that's from news or whether that's from people who comment on news, who tend to have a large following. I think it can also be true at the local level that you can have, you know, if you have a local TV station that has one particular point of view and you only watch that TV station, you're not going to know about other things.
And I guess as you look into the future, you know, where do you see TV news going? What's its role likely to look like in 5 or 10 years? You mentioned at the top that it's still kind of serving the same audience, mom and dad. It's had a change in a lot of ways. You know, how does it kind of continue to move along that path as again a lot of that audience that it's been able to hold on to starts to disappear?
Right. So what they're going to need to be doing is attracting audiences to their information. And I would, if I was predicting, I would see kind of two things. One is you're seeing more of a move toward kind of longer form documentary style pieces that in some cases use almost like narrative techniques to tell stories. And those tend to be attractive to audiences. And the other is that I think the news is going to get increasingly fragmented, that you can still think broadcast first right now, right? I'm preparing for this show, but that you're actually going to be thinking social first as a way to get the stories out to the audiences. The challenge is going to be then making that into a model where you can still afford to pay your employees to gather that news.
I was going to say, I guess it does become a situation where you may, you talked earlier kind of about the first draft of history, and TV news has kind of taken a little bit of that on from print news. It seems like there may be within that first draft, the almost first draft that you see on social platforms, whether it be from TV or otherwise, before you get maybe that kind of more reflective first draft in a formal program, whether it be a nightly TV news show or a radio program or something like that.
And that's actually an interesting thing. So I've done a little bit of research on crisis communication by news organizations on social media. Mm-hmm. And this is an example of where like a variety of sources can be useful. So if you wanted to know what was happening with a shooting in a particular city, you will get more accurate social media information from the local outlet than you will from all the national outlets that are covering it.
So people have to kind of learn to filter and where to look first if they want to get that first initial piece of news before, you know, before there's, again, that kind of maybe more longer thought out version of the story.
Right. So you might see it first from a large cable network, for example, but then you would want to go and find the local TV station or the local newspaper and follow their feed if you want like the most accurate information sooner.
Yeah, certainly, because those are the people who are on the ground there. Normally, they have sources already and things like that.
Exactly.
So we like to end the podcast by asking each of our guests the same question, and that is, where do you get your news on a daily basis? What are your kind of favorite or go-to news sources?
Okay, so I'm a journalism professor, so this is going to be a long list. I look at the websites for CNN and for Fox News. I look at the websites and occasionally the broadcasts for my local ABC and NBC affiliates. I subscribe, so I do pay for news, and I do recommend doing that if you want news to be around in the future. I subscribe to our local newspaper, the Raleigh News and Observer, as well as the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Atlantic. And I also am a sustaining member of our NPR station and listen to them.
Awesome. Dr. Amanda Sturgill, Associate Professor of Journalism at Elon University and author of the book Detecting Deception, Fighting Fake News. We thank you for joining us on this edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast.
Thank you so much. It was great.
You've been listening to the latest edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. A Matter of Facts is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Its mission is to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. We thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. A Matter of Facts is produced by Delaware Public Media. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at The Green TE, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, Delaware Humanities' Sierra Fisher, and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.